Emily Dickinson is a modern poet by all kinds of standards, even though her dates are 1830 to 1886. And that hardly puts her into what you call the modern group of people. But she's modern because of the way she says and the way she says it. And that's what makes a person modern. Dates really have nothing to do with it. I'm talking about contemporary poets, and she's not contemporary. Contemporary poets would be people like Robert Bly, Galway Connell, Allen Ginsberg, and people like that. I mean, they're right now. But Dickinson is more modern than Robert Bly or Allen Ginsberg and Galway Connell and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. She's as modern as Chaucer, which is going backwards, because Chaucer is more modern than most. When you read the Canterbury Tales, you're struck, usually every time you read them, at how modern it is. The Miller's Tale, for example, is as fresh and alive and as bawdy and ribald today as when Chaucer wrote it, and always will be. The Knight's Tale is as stately and as courtly, and the values in The Knight's Tale are as modern as anything written today. So when you say modern, sometimes it's rather confusing. So I like to talk about Emily Dickinson as a modern poet because of what she said and the way she said it. One of the things she did by way of technique was her use of off-rhyme or para-rhyme, slant rhyme. How, cow is a pure rhyme. Everybody recognizes that. But sometimes she will rhyme words that are just off a little bit, and they're not exact rhymes. An example, let's see if I have one on the sheet now that I've brought it up. Well, yes, today and victory would be an example of an off rhyme. Para rhyme, slant rhyme, it's or half rhyme, whatever you want to call it. And in 1862, a fellow by the name of Thomas Wentworth Higginson received a letter from a lady from Amherst, Massachusetts. And the lady had included four poems and said, "Dear Mr. Higginson, I read an article of yours in the Atlantic Monthly about how you need to encourage new writers and new poets. So I'm taking heart and sending you four of my poems. Sincerely, Emily Dickinson." And the four, I want to read you two of the poems that he saw. Keep in mind now that Thomas Wentworth Higginson was a man of letters, a so-called liberal thinker, had published a good deal, and was supposed to know poetry when he saw it. That's what he was professing in his article. But he was not prepared to read what he read. This is one of the four poems. It's called Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers. It's not on your list, your sheet. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin, and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them, worlds scoop their arcs, and firmaments roll, diadems drop, and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. You can imagine, just reading it once now without having the book in front of you, Dickinson is hard to follow without looking at the words. Hard for me, it's hard for everybody. You imagine in 1862, poor Brother Higginson saying, "What? Safe in their alabaster chambers?" And I can just see him putting his hand to his head, looking up, saying, "What are alabaster chambers? And who is safe in them? Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon," here's the kicker, "lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin, and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs, and firmaments roll. Diadems drop, and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow." There's an awful lot of power in that. There's a little lady from Amherst talking about the resurrection, and people just kind of lying there, waiting. Rafter of satin, which might be the shroud, whatever, but the roof of stone. And in all the things that happen while this great day is awaited, diadems dropping, doges, princes, kings surrendering, stars wheeling through the sky, all of this happening, but it's all soundless as dots on a disk of snow. That is the power of Emily Dickinson, that last line, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. That is so quiet that you can't imagine it. And I could talk ad infinitum, and I couldn't explain it better than what she's already said it. And that's also the power of Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson, maybe more than any other poet, has little lines, pithy lines, that would take essays to explain. And once you've written the essay, you haven't done it because she's already done it. Well, Brother Higginson looked at those four poems and studied them and knew that he was face to face with something he couldn't handle. And he wrote back and said, as a matter of fact, this is interesting, none of his letters are in existence anymore to her. But her letters to him are safe. That shows you what the world will put the right priority eventually. We don't remember anything about Brother Higginson except he was the lucky guy to see Emily first. But nobody saved his letters. Yeah, but they saved hers. But her letters back to him, we get the impression that he didn't encourage her. He said, well, you've got a talent there, but it's rough, and the rhymes don't work, I must tell you. Well, obviously she knew what she was doing. She was 31, I think, when she wrote that letter. Mm-hmm. She'd already written 300 or 400 poems. She knew what rhymes were and what rhymes were not, and how to make them. And she liked a lot of dashes. For those of you who've seen Emily Dickinson, I don't think the copies I've given you, yeah, they're dashed. She just dashed all over the place. For those of you who like to take freedom with punctuation, take heart from Emily Dickinson. And she liked to punctuate. She liked capital letters. She capitalized all kinds of things. E.E. Cummings came along and just did pretty much the same thing, played around with punctuation. Every now and then, maybe once in a generation, a poet will come along who will think that words are not so sacred that they can't be played with, that sounds are important. Gerard Manley Hopkins was one of those kinds of people. Didn't fool around too much with punctuation, but he fooled around a lot with sound for its own sake. Read The Windhover by Hopkins sometime. And I read The Windhover for probably 10 years before I finally got around to being scholarly and finding out what it was about. And once I knew, it didn't increase my appreciation of the poem a bit, except that I knew a little bit more, but I liked the sound. Well, anyway, Emily Dickinson knew what she was doing, and he didn't encourage her, so that was it. In her lifetime, only 2 poems were published, and she wrote almost 2,000 poems. She figured, well, if he says they're not right, or the world isn't ready, or I'm not that good, that's it. And she wrote them, and she would gather them up from time to time and fold them in little sections and bind them with little bits of, ribbon or stuff like that, and put them in little sections and put them in a box and put the box with a lid on it and put them in a drawer and told her sister Lavinia, don't look in that box. And of course, luckily for us, Lavinia did, and on Emily's death, and they started to be published. And the first editions of Emily Dickinson are rather bad because the editors didn't know what to make of the dashes, so they would throw them out. Mm. Other editors would take, and Higginson himself got to muck around with them a bit and change the rhymes and made how rhyme with cow. Mm-hmm. And poor Emily. But eventually, we have now what she meant, and you can get the complete works of Emily Dickinson now exactly as she meant them. I think there's 1,775 poems.
I kind of lost your track. Who was this fellow Higginson?
He was a writer, a poet, editor, that kind of a person, free thinker, interested in letters, interested in helping people get into print, that kind of thing. Quite well known in his day. And he was handling, though, 19th century people, 19th century poets who were writing very conventional kinds of stuff. He wasn't, and as I said, he wasn't prepared for Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson was something brand new. Usually in writing, as in all art, you can see progression. You can see where this person came from because of what this person did. You can see why Picasso was Picasso because of what some other people did before Picasso. You can see that kind of thing. Once in a while, there are people who burst full-blown on the in art, and it's very difficult to see how they arrived at their station. Emily Dickinson, I think, is one of those people. She just was an original genius. Not just genius, but absolutely original.
She spent a lot of time alone, too, didn't
she? Oh, yes, certainly did, especially after Higginson's letter. She certainly did.
Childhood.
Yes, she, right. She, yes.
So she had a kind of inner life.
Very much so.
Very rich.
Very much, yeah. Luckily for us, she did. And her imagination was so great that finally she became a recluse and didn't leave her father's house in Amherst. Her father was a pillar of the church and pillar of the community, a United States congressman, and they had the Dickinson pew in the church in Amherst and all that. And Emily, early on, balked at that. Didn't like church. Didn't like the hellfire and brimstone sermons because she was hearing on one hand sermons out of Jonathan Edwards' school, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, where Edwards describes man as a loathsome insect held over the yawning pit of hell, the flames licking up and all, God has got you held by suspended by string. She didn't like that. And on the other hand, she was hearing reading Emerson and the Transcendental Movement in New England, that whole thing, so she was kind of torn. And her poems show both those kinds of streams, the tremendous Puritan work ethic of America and the transcendental flights of imagination and wanting to get out of yourself and beyond what you are and who you are. But she did stay home a great deal, and after a while she didn't go out at all. She became a recluse, literally, and she didn't leave her father's house and stayed in his garden in the back and a lot of poems about the animals there. After a while, she took to wearing white clothes. She became known as an eccentric. People would say, well, you know, crazy Emily up on the hill. She doesn't go out. If you walk by her house and throw a rock at the window, you might see her come to the curtain. Sometimes little boys would chuck crab apples over the fence at her. You know, people are nice to other people who have other habits other than their own. They can't stand it. So that's the kind of life she lived, and she died of Bright's disease at age about 56 or 7, I think.
What is that? Yeah.
Not exactly sure what it is.
Kidneys.
Oh. Thank you.
Okay. Painful.
Well, let me read the other poem that Higginson received, okay? And then we'll get into some of these in the sheet here. This one is called I'll Tell You How the Sun Rose. But I don't think there was any telling Higginson how the sun rose. But this is how Emily Dickinson saw the sun rising. I'll tell you how the sun rose, a ribbon at a time. The steeples swam in amethyst. The news like squirrels ran. The hills untied their bonnets. The bobolinks begun. Then I said softly to myself, that must have been the sun. But how he set, I know not. There seemed a purple stile that little yellow boys and girls were climbing all the while. Till when they reached the other side, a dominie in gray put gently up the evening bars and led the flock away. Now that is a stunning description of day and night, isn't it? And I can again see poor Higginson worrying over that and writing her back saying, don't you think you should be more concrete and get your rhymes inside, your rhythm is wrong and the dashes interfere, and all kinds of advice he gave her, and then she retreated into herself. So you never know when somebody asks you something what kind of effect you're going to have. And Emily's, of course, was, I think, built in to retreat into herself. In the long perspective of things, of course, that was absolutely the best thing that could have happened. Isn't that interesting? And art is so often like that, that what you may feel or do socially may be one thing, and it may very often be a real crunch for you, your psyche, but for your art, it may turn out to be the best thing that could happen, not only to you, but to the world. And there's interesting paradoxes there, thank you, that we don't have time to explore now, but they're interesting to think about. Well, how about the first one? Success is counted sweetest by those who never succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. That is typical Dickinson. Seeing through the heart, excuse me. Boy, 10:45 is a bad time slot for me. I had this trouble yesterday, too. I don't suppose there's any brandy in the house. Yes, there probably is, but you're not going to bring it out at 10:45. Right?
I bet you I'm going to read a poem about brandy in the house.
Yes.
Days.
Well, the Dickinson, Emily has this tremendous facility for twisting things towards the end and really putting the pressure on your soul to think very deeply about what she's saying. How success is really counted sweetest by the people who don't succeed, and how the person who's dying on the battlefield, as he defeated dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. It's the clear that is the cruncher. You know, you've already fought the good fight, and you're not going to be able to enjoy the celebration because you're dead or dying. But the last strains you hear, strains of triumph, and they're not only are they agonizing, but they're clear. I mean, you can really hear it. And that just, she just puts the needle in and twists it a little bit. That's the person who suffers most. There's a great section in War and Peace, I remember. Well, there's a lot of sections in War and Peace that I don't remember, but one in particular, and I can't remember who it was, you know, the cast of characters, but for one moment, the war, Napoleon's soldiers and general, what was the great general, Russian general, was it Bokhansky? Well, you know who I mean, I've forgotten his name. But they decide to quit for a while and have a little kind of a mini armistice in this town. And all the soldiers on both sides are kind of panting in the trenches and blood streaming from their heads, and they're leaning on their muskets. As one of the captains rides into the town where they're holding these peace talks, and he sees them engaged. They have the long table spread, and they brought out all the merchants have dug up all their silver and where they've put it away so the shells wouldn't break it off, you know. And they brought out the fine china. And everybody's in their dress uniforms, all the officers. You have flowers on the table. And they're meeting, you know, the French and the Russian soldiers. And eating and talking and drinking wine and a little balalaika music in the background. And this poor officer can't believe this because he's sitting on his horse looking over here at Napoleon's troops and over here at his general's troops, the Russians, and they're all bleeding and dying, and the Red Cross are out there, the equivalent. Patch, and here these guys are enjoying their truce. That's the strains are bursting, agonizing and clear, too clear. You don't want to hear it when it's that clear because it's insanity. Well, that's the kind of thing I think Emily Dickinson brings home so well. The next one is another example. There's a certain slant of light. By the way, she never titled anything. Again, for you poets who have trouble with titles, take heart. She never titled anything. All her titles are the first lines. And whoever collected, one of the early collectors of her poems, just took the first line and stuck it up there and said, that'll do. And indeed it has. There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoon, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Now, I don't even need to read the rest of the poem. If that isn't the greatest explanation of winter afternoons, for those of you know us who have enjoyed winter at that certain time, when the long shadows are creeping across the ground, as Mark Van Doren would say, that amber twilight. And you know how lonely it can be, even though there's nothing really to be lonely about and your family's about you or close by. But there's a certain slant of light winter afternoons, that should be afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Brother Higginson changed heft to weight. It oppresses like the weight.
Well, it says the same thing, but it doesn't mean the same thing, does it? Heft is just that much different that it makes the difference, right? Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal differences where the meanings are. None may teach it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair and imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. And that's the kind of thing Emily Dickinson was writing before she ever sent that letter to Higginson. And the people in the 19th century were just not writing poems like this at all. They were writing things like Longfellow. By the shore of Gitche Gumee dwelt the wigwam of Nokomis. Now that's a good poem. And Longfellow wrote some very fine poems. But it's not Emily Dickinson. And this editor was just not equipped to handle Emily Dickinson. If he had really been worth his salt as an editor, he should have admitted it immediately and said, I don't understand it, but I sure as heck sense the genius there. You've got to send me more, and I'll publish it. But he didn't do that. He did ask for a few more. She sent him 4 or 5 more, and that was that. I mentioned going to church. She has several of her poems. She had a lot of poems about death, a lot of poems about resurrection, and a lot of doubt in between. And one time her father was getting ready to get everybody to church, and he had rounded up her brother and Austin and her mother and everybody. He said, let's go. Let's get in the carriage. Time to go. And they all got out there. I don't know if it's anything like the way we get ready to go to church. I hope not, because it's usually madness. And I wind up halfway wishing I was going to stay home because the dog's in the car and he's not supposed to be, or I've left a kid at home, or everybody's mad and it's hot, and you know how it goes. Well, I hope I'm not unique in the way we go to church. Anyway, he was out there and he said, wait, Emily's not in the carriage. He goes, went to the front door and bellowed, Emily, and no Emily. And went upstairs to a room and knocked on the door and said, Emily, we're ready to go to church. And he opened the door. Emily's room was empty. So he went out in the hall and bellowed in his stentorian voice, Emily! And everything shook, no Emily. So he pounded on all the doors downstairs, couldn't find Emily. So he went down to the basement. Didn't see why she should be there, but there was a little room down there. He went down there, tried the one door to this little room, it was locked. And he listened and he could hear the creak of her rocking chair. He says, Emily, are you in there? Creak, 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 creak. He pounded. He says, it's time to go to church. Creak, 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 creak. Then he just pounded and thundered, Emily, this is your father speaking. Open up the door. You will go to church. And then dead silence. Creak, creak, creak. And he implored, cajoled, threatened, and intimidated, but to no avail. Emily says, Father, I shall no longer go to church with you. And she no longer did. She had had it with the hellfire and brimstone, and the preacher just wasn't really interested in preaching transcendental flights of imagination, so she no longer went. And poor father thought she was lost for good. But you can see from a study of her poems that she had a great deal of her own personal faith, and she worked out her own problems her own way in her own good time, as many, many poets have done and continue to do. You want to read any in particular? There's so many that, and I've got them here. But if there's one you'd like to look at, just for the.
This one about a bird came down the walk.
A bird came down the walk on page 2. Yeah. Emily Dickinson is modern, not only for the technique she uses, but for another thing she does. She manages to keep concrete images in front of us all the time. This is a poem about the bird. But it's not about the bird. It's about something more than bird. As Gerard Manley Hopkins would say, it's about birdness. He was interested in inscape and in stress, the thing that held the thing together, that gave a leaf its form, and yet in leafness or inscape, something that was essence of leaf. Emily Dickinson does that in this poem. A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. and then hopped sidewise through the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap flashless as they swim. So you can see where she shifts gears, starts out talking about the bird, but when she's through, she's talking about a mood or a tone poem she's created. And there again is that Dickinsonian twist, the little velvet needle, God's in his heavens and all's right with the world attitude. A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. How convenient. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. Isn't it nice that God has put birds to eat worms, and then when they have eaten the fellow raw, they just turn their head with no more thought than that, expecting to be slaked, their thirst quenched, and sure enough, there's a little flower, a little leaf, and a little dew on that. He has a drink, and on he goes, on up to Cloudy Pass, with no never thought for anything. So she's needling the thought of the day that ours is not the reason why. Ours is but to go to church or die. And so her father would read maybe one or two of these poems and shake his head and say, Emily, Emily. But then the third stanza, she starts to make the shift, and she gets into the bird, how he looks, the frightened eyes like frightened beads. He stirs his velvet head like one in danger. Then she offers him the crumb. And then he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam. That's such a beautiful image when you've seen people who can really handle a canoe or a rowboat. You know what I'm talking about. If you've seen me handle a canoe, you can't see it, right? But you know the picture I'm trying to get at. Some people can dip those oars in, and it's just, you don't know where the wood begins and the water ends. It's one, right? Well, that's the analogy or the metaphor, the image she's working here. She says, that bird, when he took off, he jumped into the sky, and the sky was so blue like the ocean, and I couldn't see where his wings were really going. It was just bird and sky were one. And then she's not satisfied with that image. She says, or, you know, don't, I'm not through the poem yet, or butterflies off banks of noon. And there's another one. Ford Higginson says, what is a bank of noon? When is that? That's Emily Dickinson. And that's for you to decide. Banks of noon for me has almost always been August, September, October kind of period. Hot, maybe a little humid, very still, very lazy, with a little river that's hardly moving, with some kind of a bough sticking out, and there's a butterfly, and he leaps, and you snap it with your camera. It's a Henry Jamesian, almost still life photo, and there it is, captured. And here I talk on, and she's already done it. Butterflies off banks of noon leap, plash, not splashless, plashless. Even the sound is exactly what she wanted. And you can just see poor Higginson putting in an S. Well, you forgot the S, Emily. Splashless. Although he probably would cross it out and write in soundless or something that occurred to him. Editors are forever doing things like that. Next week I'm going to talk about the French symbolist poets, Baudelaire and Mallarmé and Rimbaud. And there's a great thing about Mallarmé, who finally got so esoteric that he started writing poems without words. And he'd leave out whole lines. He'd write a line and he'd leave out a whole page. And send this to the editor, and I can see the editor looking at this saying, well, there's nothing on this page, and sending it back or adding his own lines, and then poor Mallarmé would have to write back and say, no, I don't want anything there. And the editor wrote back and said, you don't want anything there? There's nothing there. And Mallarmé wrote back, I don't want anything there. And back and forth it goes. But that's another story. Let's take a look at, I've got a couple of marks here that I wanted to read that's not in your book, called I Died for Beauty.
I died for what?
I Died for Beauty. It's not on your sheet, but I'd like to read it for you if you'd just like to settle back and let me read this one. It's very bitter. And she could write poems with a touch of bitterness like no one else, I think. It says, I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Himself are one. We brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met at night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our name.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, that's the Dickinson crunch. I died for beauty. I died for truth. Big deal. Dead is dead. Until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our name. Nobody has that finality and stone-like feeling of Emily Dickinson. Nobody's like a safe falling out of a fifth-story window on your head. It's just absolute crunch. She can start out so delicately. She's such a tiny person. She once described herself to a friend in a letter saying, my hair is chestnut brown, my lips are such a certain kind of color. And then she said, my eyes are the color of sherry at the bottom of the glass that the guest leaves. Wow. Now, if Higginson was any kind of a man, he should have hired himself a carriage and gone over to see this woman. Anybody who could describe herself like that, with eyes like that. But no. She never married. She never... she had two or three, quote, loves in her life that were not, quote, loves, as we, I don't know what I mean by all this quote business. She had no love affair, or the N word today, relationship. Her relationships were distance. She would correspond with someone and immediately love this person from afar and would carry the torch in her own inimitable way for 20 years without maybe ever seeing the person, or maybe once. And she would write some very passionate poems for this person, and the person never knew it. One poem that I want to read to you is called My Life Closed Twice. Because she had... met two of these men that she respected and loved from afar, and they both left the area, left the state, and then she thought, well, that's all of that. And then a third person came into her life, and then she wrote this poem. My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a third event to me. So huge, so hopeless to conceive as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell. Mm-hmm. See how she saves up for those last two lines? Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell. Little Shakespearean almost in those last two lines. Well, how about another from the sheet?
Because I couldn't start the
book. Yeah, on the third page. Her death poems are certainly very solemn things. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. She doesn't wait to the end on this time. Isn't that nice of him? Oh, you didn't have to do that. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure, too, for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun, or rather, he passed us. The dews grew quivering and chill, for only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feel shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Can you remember the first time, and maybe the last time, you really thought about your own mortality? It's always a crunch, isn't it, when you really, for the first time in your life, say, hey, I am not immortal, or at least not yet. There's going to have to be a meeting of the ways where the rubber hits the road. When I die, as glorious as I am, I'm going to die. Horrible thought. Emily had that thought. And she says, I've done a lot of things since then, centuries, but boy, everything feels shorter than that first day I realized that the horses' heads were toward eternity. And I can remember the first time I ever went horseback riding, a stable horse, after I'd left the farm. I used to ride in the old plugs, the great Perchin mares, whose back was so broad I used to eat breakfast on them. But in a first stable horse in California, I couldn't make that horse go. I could entreat that horse to move. It would take hours to get him 100 yards. But then just let me get him turned around. And he's going back to the stable. He knows right. That's where the barn is and the oats were. Man, off he goes. And I might as well just sit there. It didn't matter that I had the reins. I couldn't go this way or this way. I couldn't. He wouldn't respond to anything. That's another metaphor she's using. That she's in the carriage, and she maybe has the reins, or she's sitting by the driver, but it doesn't matter. She has no control over the horse. The horse knows where he's going to the barn. Go over this hill. You may go over this by this stream. You may see this in your life. This may happen. But in the end result, the horse knows where he's going. The horse's heads are toward eternity. And that's a heck of a crunch to realize that. Gary Cooper used that same image when he talked to Ernest Hemingway. Cooper and Hemingway were great pals. And they used to joke about who was going to die first. And Cooper said, I'll get to the stable before you. I've forgotten now whether he did or not, whether which of the two went first. Cooper did first. He said, I'll get to the stable before you. That's an interesting image. Let's look at the same one, a poem on the same page. Since we're on a call, I heard a fly buzz. It's just above that poem. Another reason that Emily Dickinson is modern, not only does she have the technique that is modern with her use of off-rhyme, and her melody, her rhythms are very modern, very strident sometimes, and she also has a sense, an awareness of the meaning, the subjective meaning behind the words, very modern, and she also has a sense of 20th century reality. She wasn't writing about moons and roses and let us then be up and doing, learn to labor and to wait, philosophic kinds of things that Longfellow was engaged in. She was interested in some nitty-gritty reality, and she strikes home in this one. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. That's a powerful poem. In the 19th century, attitude towards death, or not just the 19th century, but an awful lot of attitude toward death, would the poet would have the person lying in state, as it were, with the New Testament open in a favorite passage, the crucifix around the neck, or maybe the beads. Everything would be set up, and we can imagine this person dying and then turning face to the window and seeing just before you die a fly. So just before you make that leap into eternity, it's not one of the commandments you're trying to remember, or God so loved the world, or whatever, but the last thing you see and implanted on your memory is a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz, this ugly fly inching his way up the draperies until finally disappears into infinity and you're dead. Now, when people read that, when Higginson, he never saw this, but I can just imagine, he would say, that's awful, Emily. Awful. You know, Emily. Or if her father had seen it, which was not bloody likely by this time.
How irreverent.
Pardon?
How irreverent,
yes, Emily. But that's real, isn't it? It's just as likely when we make the final leap that whatever we see last is what we remember, if you remember. And it was a plot. That's a hard reality. It's a hard-bitten reality. It's almost naturalistic in philosophy, as Émile Zola and Theodore Dreiser are naturalistic in the way they view life as animal-like, and is very, very bitter. Emily wasn't that bitter. She stopped short. Now, this is not stopping very short. But, while we're in the mood, I don't want to stay on these morbid poems too long. Maybe one more, just to emphasize a point. The last night that she lived, on the bottom of the next page. The last night that she lived, it was a common night, except to dying. See, there's that Dickinsonian treatment again. The understatement, and when you think she's not going to make a point, you've had it. It was a common night, except the dying. This to us made nature different. We noticed smallest things, things overlooked before by this great light upon our minds, italicized, as 'twere. As we went out and in between her final room and rooms where those to be alive tomorrow were a blame, that others could exist while she must finish quite, a jealousy for her arose, so nearly infinite. We waited while she passed. It was a narrow time. Too jostled were our souls to speak. At length the notice came. She mentioned and forgot. Then lightly as a reed bent to the water, struggled scarce, consented, and was dead. And we placed the hair and drew the head erect. And then an awful leisure was belief to regulate. Doesn't she just capture that not only the moment of dying, but then what? The leisure then to regulate, because that person is no longer there, that block of space is not there, and now you have a leisure, italicized as 'twere, to work around, and you have to regulate your life to somehow work around that space that is not filled anymore. And how she says that so economically is just sheer genius, friends. And then the last stanza on the first page of the poem, as we went out and in between her final room and rooms where those to be alive tomorrow were a blame. You know, you almost feel guilty for being alive and maybe enjoying something and saying, gee, I'm hungry, or I'd like a glass of water, or wouldn't a beer go good right now? And you say, oh no, she's dying in there, I can't. You know the feeling? Many times today when there are funerals and churches will have suppers for the family, you look at those kinds of things with a dual kind of feeling, don't you? It's a good thing, because at least momentarily takes the mind off the tragedy, and your friends are together and you have some consolation. At the same time, you say, now how can I say, ooh, look at those brownies. You know, you know what I mean? It's that kind of a feeling.
Yeah.
It's a bittersweet. And Emily captures it economically.
Where if you laugh and suddenly realize,
yes,
that everybody's listening to you laugh.
Sure. Somebody's told a joke.
Yeah, I always do that at one of those family funeral dinners. I always laugh and everybody hears it.
Yeah. And you feel
awful.
Terrible. Sure.
Yeah.
But it's very natural, right?
Yeah.
Sure. That's the bittersweet. As Hopkins say, the sweet, sour, dazzle, dim. Sweet, sour, dazzle, dim of life. It's, or as Joseph Conrad would say, we live in the flight. We don't live on this side or that side of life or the coin. We live in its spin. Set it spinning, and that's where life is. You just can't stop it and say, look on both sides, because it's too much of a paradox, and the paradox will kill you. Set it spinning, and that's all you've got. Let's do A Narrow Fellow in the Grass. Let's get off the death motif. One or two more, and then we'll call it quits. She spent so much of her life in her father's garden that she has a lot of poems about little animals, squirrels and things. But this fellow is a snake. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought a whiplash, upbraiding in the sun, unbraiding in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality. But never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. That sums it up, doesn't it? Huh? Isn't that brilliant? You bet it is. It's one of the best images in literature, in my opinion. That zero at the bone, that fright. You know, you're running through the woods, and all of a sudden there's a skunk or a toad or a snake or whatever. You know how that gripping in the gut and your throat. And here I am rambling on and on. And she said it in 5 words. And zero at the bone. There's just nothing left. The marrow was absolutely sucked dry. Zero. Yeah. Just brilliant image. She is so good. It's sometimes when I really get into reading Emily Dickinson, it's frightening how good she is. And I'm convinced she's the greatest American poet. Then tomorrow when I do Walt Whitman, I shall say without any qualms that Whitman is the greatest American poet. And then the next day, Frost, there's no doubt in my mind that he is the greatest.
This much badness is in Divinus Grief. I thought that part, wait a minute, much badness is Divinus Sense.
Yes.
I thought that she was, maybe she's getting the editor who doesn't think
yes.
of rhymes or whatever.
Yeah.
Comes right back.
Exactly.
There's
Here
we are, but.
Yes. I'm sure that's what she's.
What rhymes to you doesn't rhyme to me.
Yeah. And who's to say? Let's look at that poem on the top of, third page, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demure, you're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain. Boy, you'd better go along with the mob. Because if you step out of the mainstream a little bit or dare to be different in one way or another, you're going to be dangerous, and you're going to be handled with a chain by somebody sometime, and we've all experienced that, right, at one time or another. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye, much sense the starkest madness. Ain't it the truth? You can see how much there is to talk about Emily Dickinson, and we're just scratching the surface because that's exactly what I want to do. It's kind of nice just to be easy about it and relaxed. Emily Dickinson is not a sacred cow. No poet is. Poetry is not sacred. Poetry is something, and art is something to enjoy and talk and be easy with. But there's an awful lot of stuff to talk about, the technique, the rhyme, the line, the meter, and all that kind of thing. I was in a seminar once in grad school in Nebraska with a prof. It was on Frost and Dickinson, and I walked in, and we sat down, about 12 of us, and he was a mean-looking fellow, and my fears were justified, because he turned out to be the meanest man I ever met in my life. And he looked at people, and he'd point, how many poems of Emily Dickinson have you read? And this fellow said, 772. And I thought, 772, now there's an exact number. And the next guy, how many have you read? He said, 1,009. And he went right around the room. And I thought, where are these people getting these concrete astronomical numbers? 526. How would they remember they'd read 526? He got to me and I said, a couple dozen? And boy, the whole room just stared my way. I knew I was in for it because I had only read a couple dozen. I really think those other guys had read a couple dozen too, but they were, when the pointing finger points and moves on, you had better say your thing. He said, our job this seminar will be a textual study of Frost and Dickinson. What that means is we're going to go through all the editions of Frost and Dickinson and find out where the commas were left in and where the dashes were left out. I thought, that ain't for me. So I excused myself and never went back. But that's one of the things you can devote your study to if you're a mind to. where the commas were in and where they were left out. I think Emily Dickinson would rather you think about what she's saying and why she said it, maybe, than whether the dash is there or the dash is not there. Well, let's close with a couple I want to read to you. It's not in your sheet, okay? Because we've got to get ready for lunch. That's the highlight of the day. After breakfast, and then, of course, just before supper. I seem to spend my whole life up here wondering about what's to eat. And I can't possibly be hungry.
You're certainly not alone.
And then when they run out of ice cream, of course. Oh, oh my. Well, let's see, what have I got here? I want to read you a quick one called Faith is a Fine Invention. It's only four lines, but what she does with those. Faith is a fine invention when gentlemen can see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency. Yes. And I'm nobody. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog. To tell your name the livelong June to an admiring bog. Thanks for coming.